I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of I Do Not Have Trash Politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Seen, the podcast. Sometimes it feels impossible to change ourselves or to change the world, but change happens all the time. We will never become perfectly healed. We will never achieve a utopia, but we will change ourselves and we will change the world. So, how will we shape that change? I imagine that what I just said will land very differently with different people, or will even land differently with the same people on different days. I wrote it with a sense of hope, and that's usually what it inspires in me, but there have been times that this kind of appeal to hope would have just felt like pressure, or triggered shame, or triggered cynicism. Like, yeah, the world is changing and I'm changing and it's all getting worse and worse. And I'm saying all this because our topic today is one that maybe on the surface would seem like a feel-good or a positive topic, but for many people, it might actually feel more frustrating or more frightening or more difficult to access than something like our last topic, grief, which on the surface seems so much heavier. So let's settle in, and Nick, let me start by asking you how you're feeling about our topic today, which is hope.
I'm feeling good about it. I'm not surprised about the piece you just said around, like, that talking about hope can sometimes feel, like, actually kind of shitty or, like, shameful or all these things, but it kind of did surprise me. So I'm really curious and excited for us to talk about how this thing that's usually so positive and so, you know, like supposed to be like inspiring and like motivating and blah, 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 like hope can also be challenging, and like where you would suggest we bring some more attention to or tenderness to or like nuance to. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this. And also your nails look really good. Can I just say?
Thank you so much. They are cheap press-ons.
No shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Look at you.
I'll tell you the brand after this.
Please, yeah. I don't wanna, not endorsing.
You know, get into the controversial game of the press-on nails.
Too good.
So yeah, I think I want to start by talking about some of the barriers, some of the things that makes hope difficult, because I feel like we can't really settle into hope before we address why it is so challenging for so many people to access. Have you had times where you feel like hope is something that is just really difficult to access?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, there were parts of my life where I stopped wanting things to change, especially when I was a kid and I felt like I had so little control over things were happening in my family and my family dynamic. And I definitely got to a point where it felt much more safe, I guess, to just accept that things wouldn't change. And it felt like there was so much more potential to be disappointed or, yeah, like let down if I held on to something that, like, retrospectively, like as an adult, I'm like, oh, the things that I wanted were to have like more open communication in my family or for like my parents' relationship to change in a way that would have felt quote unquote, like normal. And those are really reasonable things for a child to want. And so retrospectively, I can appreciate that, like, oh, it's really sad that I felt like I had to let go of that hope or that desire or that longing, because every kid should have as much stability and care and clarity about who they are and their family and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely went through phases in my life where I was like, well, like, scrap that shit. Like, you know, and then I remember, especially when I was a teenager, feeling a bit of, I don't even think it was actually shame. It was more just like the hopes that I had had were kind of, I remember feeling like they were kind of like little kiddish or like delusional or like, you know, so maybe that's like in a sort of inner critic coming out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it does resonate with me, but I was just really curious and interested about the disappointing piece. Cause yeah, I think so often when we talk about hope, it's like this sort of galvanizing thing. And by that, it also can feel like it's, there's like this collectivist, like it's not just about like what we personally hope for. It's also extends to what we hope the future holds for like us as a species, like as humans or like, you know, like I remember when Barack Obama was running for president during his first, like before his first term, like that was sort of his platform was like hope, mm-hmm. right? And it was like this inspiring thing that was like really attractive and I would even say kind of seductive. And he was successful because he ended up being elected president. But yeah, anyways, curious, interested, definitely resonates for me. How about for you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think you spoke to so many aspects of this topic that we will unpack more and dive deeper into. But yes, so I think my 20s was the biggest time that I found it very difficult to access hope, because I think the realities of like adult life and maybe almost maybe what you experience in your teens, sort of a lot of the things that I think I had hoped for my life started to feel really delusional. And I just felt like I'm in so much debt. I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. Like I couldn't see how that was going to get better. So I think I felt a lot of despair and a lot of fear at that time. And it's funny that you mentioned Barack Obama. You know, he has that book, The Audacity of Hope. And yes, hope and change was the whole platform. But then I think after he was elected, I think that's maybe part of why there was maybe such a sort of disappointment. I think there were a lot of people that maybe then expected so much more from him. You know, expected that he was going to be able to really create a type of like sweeping change that he didn't, and that he wasn't necessarily that interested in as somebody who's
part of like a political establishment, you know?
Yeah. And by my standards, he's conservative, right? Like, I think he's quite liberal, maybe in the bigger American standards. Sort of
big P politics, but he's a classic liberal. I mean, he came from like very like community organizing spaces, but even in that work, I didn't get the sense that he was like Black Panthers level radical, right? Like that wasn't the kind of work that he was even engaged in prior to becoming president. So yeah, I think you're right. There was a lot of disappointment in what I think folks hoped he would have ushered in or transformed by way of like the actual political system, the political like landscape. And we didn't see that. That didn't happen. Right.
Yeah. And then it's like that's on a kind of broader societal level, what you also talked about personally that I think a lot of people feel, which is if you have hope, then you're much more likely to then have to experience disappointment or hurt or whatever the feelings are if things don't go the way that you hoped. And I think for a lot of people, it maybe feels safer to expect the worst because then you're always prepared for it.
Totally.
Versus if I open myself up and I allow myself to hope, then I'm going to be crushed.
Well, there's the element of control or what we think we have control over that I think is really makes sense. Like, you know, we have as human beings, like we want to have as much agency and control and be able to predict like the things that are coming. And if we don't have that, it's, I don't know, frightening. And then it calls into question like whether, I remember for me in my worst moments where I was like, and we've talked about this, the question of like, how dare I, or like, who am I to want such a thing? Like, you kind of just like makes you feel like certain things, certain experiences, especially on a personal level, are like for other people and not for you. And it's not even like you want to feel that way or think that way, but it's mm-hmm. certainly been an accessible frame of mind for me.
Absolutely. And I think there is also, I'm wondering if you're feeling this part of it when you say, who am I to want these things? That there is a fear for a lot of people of, if I hope for this and then it doesn't happen this way, I look like a fool.
Totally.
Right? There is totally. Like a little bit of a, I'm stupid, I'm naive, I'm an idiot for yes. having ever hoped for that.
Absolutely. And it's like, you don't want to get caught slipping. You don't want, you know, you just like, and that's been interesting, like in my today life, trying to interrupt those kinds of frames of mind or, you know, attitudes, because I have to ask myself, who am I afraid of? Like, who's, you know what I mean? Like, who am I scared to be embarrassed in front of? Like, who is that person? Is there a person I have in mind, or is it just sort of like, so yeah, that totally resonates with me.
Well, and it makes me think about what this says about how we react to each other. Hmm. You know, like I am wondering, like, what are the ways that we laugh at people for taking risks and failing, or that we judge people who should have known better, or, you know, we fail to be there for people in their grief. Like, mm-hmm. I think sometimes it is in our imagination, like an imagined
audience.
Yeah, an imagined audience. But where did that imagination come from? Because mm-hmm. I think more often than not, it came from very real experiences, either of having that sort of judgment and ridicule, or just observing people judge and ridicule people who put themselves out there in that way.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Another aspect of this for me is who has access to hope and who doesn't. Recognizing some of the systemic barriers that we face. I'm thinking, as somebody with a disability, what if your condition isn't going to get better? Or what if, in fact, it's actually degenerative? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, people who don't have much access to money. It's very difficult often to imagine how are things going to get better when you're in particular situations and you don't have the resources to dig yourself out of those situations. Or, you know, folks where within their community, there are fewer elders. You don't get to see a lot of examples of people like you surviving mm-hmm. and thriving. And, you know, maybe there's increasing legislation targeting you, like all of these things that make it very difficult to have hope. And of course, none of these things mean that we can't have hope. I'm not trying to say that people in these communities cannot have hope. Like, often we're the ones who have the most hard-fought relationships to hope, and we're the ones who figured out
exactly
all of the magic spells to create it out of nothing.
Right.
And also, like, I think there can be so much pressure to be hopeful. And so much sort of judgment and shaming and even abandonment if you are really struggling to access hope when you have these really significant barriers in your way.
Yeah, because the question of who gets to be hopeful is so interesting, in particular because there are many of us who experience or benefit from like a lot of privilege, and we might have in our desire to see the world look and feel and be more just and liberatory and caring. Like, I think, like, we are not even in the thick of it, so we don't even sometimes know just how challenging it is for folks who are on the front lines experiencing their world, their state, their sense of security get worse and worse and worse. And so, yeah, I just, there's something about that question of like, who gets to be hopeful? And then like, when do some of us who have privilege need to shut the fuck up about shit? Cause I, you know, like, are we helping? Like, are we really helping? And the point you said before, but like, where's there's pressure that people are experiencing and having to be hopeful. It's like, I hope to God that it's not pressure to be positive or to like, you just keep trucking along. Like, you know, I just, there's something interesting about like that question of who gets to be hopeful and like how many of us are taking up a lot of space, and that space taking is actually amounting to unnecessary pressure for those who are like in the thick of it, actually experiencing the things that we are hopefully in allyship, you know, to fight against or support or whatever. It's just, yeah, more and more I'm trying to think of like, when do I need to shut the fuck up about things? Because I have no idea about how hard it is for some folks.
So I think that question of who gets to be hopeful is important. I also think a kind of flip side of that can be who has to be hopeful, like who is forced to be hopeful. I do feel definitely as someone with a chronic illness, if I'm in a space of being hopeful and positive about it and thinking, well, I'm, you know, I'm going to try this thing that I've tried 10 million times before. I'm just going to keep looking, even though I've been looking for so many years, and just staying in this place of hope. People are much more likely to be willing to engage with me, to have conversations with me about what I'm experiencing. They're going to find it easier to be around me, and so therefore they're going to be around me more. They're going to maybe find me inspiring, all of those things.
Right.
If I'm not in that place, people are going to avoid me.
Yeah.
And so it's like maybe in the times that I would need it the most, because it's looking pretty bleak, people aren't going to be there because, I mean, I think there's a layer of judgment, and maybe it's a coping mechanism because it can be an intense energy to be around a sort of like hopelessness or despair. It can trigger other people's fear and despair. But that coping mechanism is often judgment. It's like, well, you're not doing anything to help yourself. Meanwhile, it's like, I've been doing everything to help myself every day for many, many years.
Yeah.
But I think that shaming, for wherever it comes from, that shaming is so real.
Totally. I can imagine, but I can also sense, just in that story alone, like your own personal experience, that shit has such a big impact. And it's like hard not to clock it. Like, it's hard not to tell, I'm sure, when people pull away, or when, you know, it's like, oh, this is more palatable for for this person or these people. Like, this feels like less, I don't know, activating, perhaps, like you said, if it's triggering something in me or whatever about my own, I don't know, understanding about like life and temporality, you know, like just all of that stuff. Right. So makes sense.
Absolutely. So I feel like I really want us to differentiate now between hope as toxic positivity, which is sort of what I'm alluding to in that last example, hope as this thing that's like, God has a plan. Everything happens for a reason. Let's just shut out any kind of fear or any kind of acknowledgement of the fact that things don't work out for the best for everybody in every situation, avoiding grief, all of those things, versus maybe a more grounded and a more practical hope. Does that bring anything up for you, just me even saying those two things?
Yeah, I don't really know what quite yet, but definitely you saying grounded, practical hope. It feels a lot more tied to, I know this is a really negative, has a really negative connotation, but like instant gratification, but like it feels like there's something more accessible materially now than always kind of imagining this one perfect day into the future. But you, that phrase of grounded hope. Mm. And the toxic positivity, it's so seductive. Like, it's so, mm-hmm. there's something about it that I get why we struggle with it. You know, I get why it's like, it comes so easily or so naturally. You know, it's not like it's completely unfathomable that when we don't have the answers or we don't know what to say or we don't know what to do, that our first instinct or immediate thought is, you know, just change, like just focus on, just ignore, just sort of escape, just silence. Like, it makes sense. Like, I think for all of the really terrible side effects and impact of toxic positivity in and of itself, I understand why folks go there. Because there are so many things that we don't have control over, and humans are in the business of trying to make sense out of everything that we experience, you know? But it doesn't always have the benefits, and it doesn't always have the good impact that we intend. And I think I would be really curious to learn from you if you have any ideas about how to create, even in our relationship, more grounded expressions of hope. How can I be, I hope I'm not toxically positive to you, but yeah, I'm just curious. And then flipping the question back to you, of course, like, how do you differentiate the two, toxic positivity and a grounded hopefulness?
Yeah, I guess for me, toxic positivity, there's sort of having tunnel vision. It's sort of hope and nothing else. And I think the difference is when we are able to sit with the full spectrum, mm-hmm. where we don't have to be in hope in every single moment. I want to explore maybe different ways of understanding hope that to me feel more grounded or more real, even. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like something I can sort of actually feel deep in my core as opposed to a sort of avoidant, you know, platitude.
Right.
And to open, our theme, of course, for this season is transformative justice for self. So transforming the conditions within and around ourselves in order to allow for change and for healing, for better conditions for us. Transformative justice teaches us to hold on to the possibility that things can shift and allows us to realize that since we have changed, it means others can change too. And in this context, I would say it also means holding on to the fact that things have changed and things will continue to change. Mm-hmm. But again, that doesn't mean it's going to change for the better necessarily.
Right.
So getting into some of the possibilities of different ways to understand hope. One of the big ones for me is hope as a creative vision. In the book Care Work, Leah Lakshmi Piyapsnasmara Sinha talks about sort of creating the conditions for things to get better. So what would it mean to create the conditions for hope? And I'll offer a content warning here for mentions of suicide. Leah Lakshmi Piyapsnasmara Sinha tells a story about an experience a lot of people had in community a few years ago where there was a series of high-profile suicides of femmes. And they really dig into how that impacted femmes across all of these communities that they were a part of, and all of the reasons for suicidality in femmes that are often overlooked. But they ended up sharing how they, along with some other femmes, created, they called it feminars, about femme suicidality. And this really created a sense of community, and it helped folks to share femme brilliance and resiliency practices. So I felt like this was such a beautiful example of how even being with some of the most difficult experiences and the most difficult possible emotions, we can still have a vision for something better.
Hmm.
And we can still work together to create conditions for things to be different.
I feel like something that's so important to raise is the word better, because I feel like the foundation of our hopefulness, and it has to be rooted in, like, there is a level of, dare I say, like, incrementalism that we have to be able to appreciate, I think. Because if we don't, I guess maybe the risk is nothing will ever be the same again, and we'll never find anything worth living for or moving forward towards, or, you know what I mean? So just that appreciation that better is not, it's not the worst thing. It actually can create for us some of the things that we need the most in, like, the worst moments. If we can appreciate that perfection or best or turning back the clock to before the worst things have happened, that's not possible. And so, yeah, there's something about that that I just wanted to raise a bit, like, that that is also a really incredible story. Like, thank you for sharing the ways that folks have created the care that they needed for themselves and for others after so much tragedy. And it probably didn't, like, meet every and all need, but, like, it met a core need that helped cultivate the care that was required for that moment in time. And, like, that's a really beautiful thing. And I, and the reason why I raise that is because I think oftentimes in so much of our liberatory work, what we have in mind are these sites of perfection, or these, like, is that true? Like, how do you feel about me saying that, I guess, is the question. Because it's like, there's no part of me that thinks we don't deserve, or that folks don't deserve, for all of the tremendous amounts of suffering and pain and harm and the systems that facilitate the suffering, pain and harm to end. Like, I don't want to be like, well, we should, that's delusional. But there is something to be said about what that does to us and how that can distort or hinder or just make it more challenging for us to appreciate the better of it all, like the things that are the slightness of it, like the, yeah, I don't know if this is even making sense to you. Like, what are your thoughts on better?
Yeah, what it brings up for me is, in therapy, often we talk about, like, 5% solutions or even, like, 1% solutions, or, like, 0.1% solutions. I think that's really, really important in making things accessible. Because, yeah, for a lot of people in a lot of conditions, there is not a 100% solution. There just isn't. I don't think that's what life is. There often isn't a solution. But if we can find those 5% or 0.1% strategies, and we really practice them and we really build on them, it actually does really change our conditions. And that might just mean having a little bit of a break. Maybe we work hard at it, and then we find that we can sometimes have, like, a 5-minute break from
the suffering
or distress.
Totally.
The suffering, exactly. Yeah. And maybe that sounds small, or maybe it sounds like it's not enough. And it, I mean, I can't say that it is enough.
I can't either. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. I wish that folks had more. And I understand that for some people that isn't going to feel like enough. But my experience has been that it can really make a difference, and it can just create kind of openings. It can create openings that allow things to happen that maybe we wouldn't have expected.
I think that's where I feel most comfortable or that's why I feel most comfortable saying what I said about better or like incrementalism when it comes to mm-hmm. or just having that as an orientation that we can also appreciate. Because yeah, for me, I've found when I'm able to, and I love that phrase of like 5%, you know, or 1% or like something like really small, because it doesn't really matter what the number is really. It's more just like giving yourself the permission to appreciate, be attuned to, recognize, affirm the ways that things are moving in a direction that is affirming or supportive for us. And like looking out for that. I don't know. I just think one of the gifts of something like organized religion is that it can provide folks an anchoring. And it's not even organized religion, really. It's just like faith, right? Like any kind of faith-based practice, it can give folks a lot of stability or a sense of like an anchor or like a compass or whatever it is. And it's like, we don't all need that. Let's not mince words here, Nick. There's no part of me that thinks like we should all be practicing an organized religion. But I do really think that with that in mind of where can we find a little bit of an anchor? Where can we find a little bit of like, where are those little micro movements? Even if it's a distraction or even if it's like you said, a break or whatever it is that we are really deserving of, that we should take them. Mm-hmm. Wherever we can find them. So yeah, thank you for offering that. Because I was like, oh God, maybe I'm saying some shit that is so counter to what people really need. And I'm grateful also that you mentioned that there's no part of us that, or there's no part of you, but us, that feels like folks just deserve that little 1% or 2%. Like sometimes that's all that we have access to. And I don't want to ever minimize what that 1% could materially feel like or be like for us. So yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up the organized religion piece. It's not about organized religion for me, please, but I do see hope also potentially as an openness to a higher power or a spirituality or just even an openness to the unknown. Mm-hmm. I feel like it doesn't even need to be spiritual. Maybe we can all find our different ways of understanding this if there's people who spirituality doesn't resonate with. It's interesting. I when I was preparing this episode, I came across an article in Psychology Today that was like, I can't remember the exact title, but it was like the 7 downsides of hope, or it was like the 7 problems with hope, something like that. And there was this perspective in it that, well, here's actually a quote from the article. It says, if you proceed in your endeavors without hope, independently striving to accomplish whatever objectives you've set for yourself, you'll be taking full responsibility for your future. And to me, I just find that I understand what they're saying, but to me, it feels so obnoxiously individualist and white and sort of colonial, just this idea that we are these independent beings who have full control or full responsibility for how our lives go. To me, that's just not reality. The way I feel, I can see like an opening for spirit or some kind of higher power, but it doesn't have to be that. What about like an opening for community or for just factors outside of ourselves? Because there's what we can do for ourselves, but that is like one small piece,
right,
of what determines how things go for us. I don't know. How is this all landing with you?
It is landing. It reminds me of yesterday. I was walking, going to an appointment, and there was somebody that was performing, a busker performing Que Sera Sera, which is the song my mom used to sing when I was a kid, like all the time. She didn't know any of the, she didn't know any other verse, but just like when I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what shall I be? And she'd always sing Que Sera Sera off key. And the reason that I'm reminded of that in what you just said is like the reality. And I think it's weird because you had said earlier a grounded hope. And I was like, that resonates with me. And I think that part of grounded hope is also the appreciation that there are going to be things that are beyond ourselves. Like the reality is that there are things beyond our control that might benefit us, affirm us, surprise us, delight us, push us towards the thing that we want more or most, make things better. You know, there's something about that. So I appreciate, yeah, that comment around taking full control, like taking full like responsibility for your future or whatever. Personally, I like the idea of the universe just sprinkling a little bit of something that I don't know about that's coming down. You know, like that is actually much better because I'm like, sometimes I make the wrong decisions. Like sometimes I make the, like I make a bad choice. Absolutely, like I would like to be able to also be delighted by and blessed by things that I didn't see coming. I think that that is part of sort of the mystery of the way that the world works. And that still feels grounded to me. And maybe that sounds wild, but it just goes together for some reason.
Yeah, because I mean, the reality is that we don't know.
Yeah.
So I think that is grounded to say, I don't know. You know, there's going to be a lot of factors that have nothing to do with me. Another way of thinking of it maybe is hope as being curiosity.
Yeah, I love that.
Right? Just like, what's coming next? You know, I made it through today and what's coming next is a mystery, and maybe being even just open to that mystery.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if hope could even be in some ways almost a neutrality. Like, not things are going to be only good. I think that would be maybe toxic positivity, right? To be like, I hope that everything that happens in the future of my life is going to be 100% pleasant. Like that.
Yeah.
Is that's delusion to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That is the delusional side of hope, I think. But also thinking every single thing that happens in the future of my life is going to be bad, I think I can understand why people might feel that way. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's cynical. Like, I get where that cynicism comes from for some people. But I think it's also not a grounded realism. I think the reality is that there is going to be a mix of things. And I wonder if hope could even just be a sort of recognition that there will be a mix of things.
Yeah. I like this. I like where you're going with that. It feels real, like you said before, and it doesn't ignore the real shit that one of the problems that I have with toxic positivity, both the fact that it's kind of like blinders on, like you said before, but also it creates this vacuum in which, you know, you can't have hope and a bit of confusion, or hope and a little bit of something else. And when you were saying like earlier in the podcast, when you raised the thing about grounded hope, that's all I could think of is like hope and like there's like, I think it's great for us to have an appreciation of duality where, right? Because sometimes things are happening and you're like, what the fuck? Like, how am I gonna, what is gonna happen here? Or we're like, I'm hopeful, but also like, I'm pissed. Like, this is not how I expected it to be. Like, I'm like losing control of something. Or maybe we never had control in the first place and we're coming to terms with that. Like, but I think that there's, yeah, like a lot more to work with if there's room for hope and when we come across teachings or folks in this world who suggest that the only way through is to sort of only appreciate or focus on things that we have never materially ever benefited on, like never seen, like it's never come to fruition. We're just supposed to be like in there. I think that that's a tall order. I think that that's not fair. I don't think it has the intended outcome that we hope for. Haha.
Maybe the last thing I'll say is in that same chapter in Care Work, the author said they had a quote on their altar that said, grief can be the garden. And that just stirred so much in me. I looked it up, and the full quote, it's from Rumi, and it says, "Grief can be the garden of compassion. If you keep your heart open through everything, your pain can become your greatest ally in your life's search for love and wisdom." And I think to me, that really captures that grounded, complex hope that it's not about denying pain. It's not about ignoring pain. But if we can stay open, we really don't know what will grow. And there's just something beautiful about the curiosity or the openness to just sticking around and finding out what will grow.